Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Well, hi, everybody. Fasten your seatbelts. You are in for a ride. This is going to be so much fun. My guests today, I have two men, Dr. Malcolm Lessevoy and Cliff Meidel. Now, Dr. Lessevoy is a member of the American Board of Plastic Surgery, a certified plastic surgeon, and a professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at UCLA Medical Center, and now he's in private practice in Beverly Hills. And Cliff is a spokesperson, speaker, and two-time Olympian. And what you're going to hear is how this all happened. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're so welcome. And I think we'll start with you, Dr. Lessevoy, if I may call you Malcolm going forward. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. Well, you don't have to call me going forward, just Malcolm.
Okay, there we go. That's joke one, if anybody is keeping track. All right. So I told you this is going to be fun. So please tell our listeners a little bit about your background, sir.
Yes, I'm a board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon. I've been professor at UCLA Medical Center and chief of plastic surgery at Harvard General Hospital in Los Angeles for 25 years, and now I'm in private practice. So while I was full-time at UCLA, I did mostly reconstructive surgery, all extremities, hand surgery. I've written three books on plastic surgery and hand surgery, and started the service, the hand surgery service at UCLA and hand surgery. And did all kinds of craniofacial surgery, cleft lip, cleft palate, things of that sort, and aesthetic surgery. But now I'm in private practice in Beverly Hills doing mostly aesthetic surgery.
Got it.
But I was born and raised in Pennsylvania, went to college in North Carolina, and did general surgery, medical school and general surgery in Chicago, and then plastic and reconstructive surgery in Miami under Dr. Ralph Millard, and then was hired to come to UCLA and be a full-time professor there, and here we are.
Wow, that's exciting. Well, I have a daughter that's a UCLA alum. It's a wonderful school to be proud to be associated with.
Yes.
So Cliff, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, I'm essentially an accident survivor, so I'll start off with that. It's a shocking story, but we'll get into that a little bit later on. But anyway, so I was born and raised in Manhattan Beach, California, kind of a young kid growing up here at the beach cities, enjoyed a lot of sports. But nowadays, I end up a vice president for a development company, so I do that for my 9-to-5, but I have an incredible passion, and I really like to go out and do public speaking. So that being said, I started my public speaking career after I retired from the Olympics in Sydney 2000, and I started going back out there and really trying to inspire people essentially to, be the best that they can be, because I do a lot of motivational, inspirational talks, but I think more on the important side and the real passion side is to really hit the boots on the ground to those people that are out working construction and really talk about how important it is to be able to work safe, because, we all have families, we all have loved ones that really care about us a lot, and it's, our personal responsibility to make sure that not only do we go to work safe, but also come home at the end of the day. So that's my big passion, is being able to go out there and do motivational talks on that.
I think that's so interesting. And I just, a side note here, so I talked about my daughter that went to UCLA and got a degree in theater arts. However, she's in her 17th year of commercial construction, running a very large job downtown at LACMA. And safety is critical in what she does in that work. And we're going to get a little bit more into what you did and what happened to you. But I do think that's an important subject for you to talk about. Why don't you tell our listeners how it was that you came to meet each other?
Well, essentially, there's a couple of phases to how Dr. Lesovo and I ended up meeting. I'll let him talk about one of his parts, but my initial part was is that I was going through this extreme adversity where I was in a hospital for about a month in time. I had suffered a severe electrical accident, and I was at the risk of losing both of my legs. And my mother ended up calling Dr. Lesovoyne, and that's how initially I was able to meet Dr. Lesovoyne on the first standpoint. And then later on, he can explain how we met the second time. So that's essentially our first introduction. It was a very incredible introduction, especially for those people that know what it's like facing extreme adversity. You know, when your back is up against the wall. And when I first met Dr. Lesovoy, he lit this flame of hope in my heart that he was going to be able to do some good for me and save my legs. Yeah, so that was our first introduction.
What happened that you met him? What was the situation that caused the two of you to meet?
Well, what happened was is that, you know, I was 19, 20 years of age. I was working on a construction site. At that time, you know, my hopes were to develop a trade, but at the same time be able to educate myself. So I was going through community college as well and going to trade school. And I was working on a job one morning doing a task that I had done many times, and I was working with a coworker, and I ended up operating a jackhammer, and I pierced three power lines that were beneath this concrete, and each one of them had 4,160 volts. So I received an enormous electrical shock, and I ended up having a cardiac arrest. I was very fortunate that first responders were very close by. But like my mom always says, I guess you can't kill a weed, right? You're here for a reason. So there's always an intent for all of us to be here. But, you know, Dr. Lesovoy is perfect at explaining, you know, how electricity works when you're involved in an incident and what type of damages I had.
So that would be great. Go ahead, Malcolm. Why don't you share that part?
Okay. So, you know, when this occurred to Cliff, the amount of energy, of electrical energy that he received, we found out, is about three times the amount that is used in the electric chair. For bad people. And he survived, fortunately, and was then taken to one of the local hospitals in the South Bay area here of Los Angeles, where they did immediate resuscitation and care. And essentially, electrical burns are all kind of, there are three different kinds of burns that I mentioned. There are flame burns, heat burns, you know, from a fire, and you can see it, you know, burns and destroys the outer skin, and can be somewhat deeper. Then there are electrical burns, which is this electrical energy that essentially enters your body from the point of contact and then has to exit someplace. But it is, in my opinion anyhow, more severe than all burns are really bad, but what happens is you can't see the actual damage because it goes through your body, usually burns muscles and nerves and blood vessels that you can't see because it's inside, and then exits. And in his particular case, the burns exited from the back of his scalp and his knees. It's conceivable that when this occurred, he probably dropped to his knees and then hit the ground essentially and was grounded, and that's where the energy exploded. So it essentially destroyed both of his knees. And then there's a third kind of burn where you can burn by your girlfriend or your boyfriend and or your husband or wife. That's just a joke. But anyhow, That's the other kind of burn. So with his injuries, he had immediate care and was in the hospital for about a month, and the necrotic tissue, dead tissue, was removed from the back of his skull, from his back, and from his knees. And that's where the problem occurred, because it damaged his knees, his lower extremities, so severely that the doctors there were going to remove both of his legs above the knee, so he would have bilateral above knee amputations. And fortunately for Cliff, his parents, his mother specifically, stepped in, and maybe Cliff can go further with that situation.
Go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that a lot of people don't really realize, especially, you know, when you're speaking on occupational health and safety, you know, worker safety, is that, you know, there's the iceberg, and we see the top of it where an individual gets into an accident, but what we don't see is what lies beneath the water. And what lies beneath the water oftentimes are our immediate family that had to get involved in this. And, you know, my parents received a phone call from the superintendent on the work site saying that Cliff's been involved in a bad accident, and he followed up with, well, we don't know if he's going to live or not. So you can imagine my mom, I think she was about 42 years of age when she gets this call. And, you know, we're not, as humans, we're not trained in adversity 101. You know, these traumatic experiences just happen just like that, and you have to react whether you're an individual or a family. And my situation was very dire because I was completely unconscious. I was fighting for my life. My mom gets this call, and both parents show up to the hospital, and they're, you know, immersed in this extreme traumatic situation. And everybody essentially tells my mom, you know, hey, listen, lady, you know, you can't come into the trauma room right now. Your son's in critical state. And I've learned in the past that's one of the things that you never tell a mother is the word no. My mom kind of took it as on. Every time you told her no, it meant on. And so anyway, she barges into the room there, and there I was laying on this breadboard, and my knees were smoldering. And, you know, my mother really didn't know what to do. The only thing that she could do at that time was whisper into my ear, fight as hard as you possibly can fight to live. And, you know, the power of the human spirit is immense. It's amazing what we can do when we're conscious. You know, I always like to say we're all ordinary people, but we have the ability to accomplish the extraordinary. It's all from the neck up. But even in an unconscious state, it's amazing the power of the human spirit. And, you know, luckily I'm here today to talk about this. I lived, right? But it was a very rocky road for my mom and dad going forward. You know, the snowball effect just kept getting worse, bigger and bigger. And then we were put to this situation where I was going to have, you know, both of my knees, legs amputated at one point in time. My father told me a story where he and my younger brother were coming up in an elevator, and the doors opened up, and here these doctors had walked in. You know, they were wearing their white coats and everything, and they were, you know, talking about all their different clinical situations that they were having, their cases, until one of the doctors said, hey, did you hear about the kid up in ICU? And that is when my father, standing in the back of the elevator, developed this huge lump in his throat, and he knew that our family was in a world of hurt, because what the doctor had said was they're probably going to have to do bilateral AKs on that kid, which is amputating above the knees. And so you can imagine when the news gets up to the ICU, and there's my mom standing there, right? No means on. Everybody in our audience can, you know, take that in there. Way of visioning this. And so my mother was, you know, relentless, and that's when she ended up trying to be as resourceful as possible. And then that's when she had talked to Dr. Lessevoy, and he can explain what that telephone call was all about.
Yes. Why don't you? What happened after that? What happened next?
Very interesting. So I'm in my clinic seeing patients at UCLA, and I get this phone call from this lady who asked me to come and see her son. And she had heard that I did this kind of innovative surgeries and things of that sort, not brand new surgeries, but types of surgeries that are unusual. And said that her son was in this hospital. would I come and see him? I said, well, no. I mean, I only work at UCLA, and that's not my hospital. But so she hung up and then called back and was crying. And mm-hmm. I'm kind of a, you know.
Shocked.
Yeah, exactly. And so I said, well, okay, I'll come down and just see him as a family member or something. And, and so I did come down to his room at this other hospital and looked at things and said, well, maybe we could do something. And if I could take him up to UCLA, we'll do some surgery and hopefully save his legs. But the doctors there were very reticent about discharging him because they had him on the schedule for the following morning to remove both of his legs above the knees. And so we had a little confrontation with the doctors, and finally we were able to convince them to at least let me try. And I said, so let me bring him up, and if we fail, then you know, I'll send him back down and you can then take his legs off. So they kind of acquiesced. But basically I went in to meet Cliff, and I think he remembers when I was there. Cliff?
I mean, it was like yesterday. I remember that very well. And like I mentioned, as we first started off on the conversation, you know, adversity, I always like to say it's like death and taxes. It's just a matter of when we're going to go through it, right? And it's a management process.
Right.
You know, we got to learn that if we get knocked down on our butt, we got to be able to develop that resilience and that determination to be able to get back up and stand up again and fight that fight. But there are sometimes, you know, in our audience, all of our audience members can probably imagine this. I mean, you do face adversities that sometimes your back is up against the wall. You have absolutely no hope, and you want to throw the towel in. You just want to quit because you know it's going to be too hard or you don't think you're going to make it. And that's kind of the situation that I was in at the time. And then you can imagine, I only remember 3 days in a one-month period when I was at the burn center, and this one night this gentleman walks in, and he was wearing his signature cowboy boots. He was wearing jeans, and he had a white type of T-shirt on with these big muscles and this very deep voice, as everybody can hear now how great of a voice Dr. Lesovoy has. But the unique thing about it is as he walked into the room, he acknowledged my folks and the doctors that were in the room, but he came straight to my bed, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he says, "Hey, Cliff," with his deep voice, "I'm Mal Lesovoy, and I'm here to take a look at your legs." Not Dr. Lesovoy, not Malcolm Lesovoy or anything like that. "I'm Mal, and I'm here to take a look at your legs." And I can tell you, when your back is up against a wall and you're going to lose everything in your life, you know, you're even possibly fighting for life, it's amazing what you grab onto, what the human spirit grabs onto. And at that time, I literally grabbed onto Dr. Lesovoy just hoping that he was going to be able to do some good. So that was the first point in my story where he was able to light this flame of hope in my heart that I just maybe, just maybe might be able to get through this situation. And that's basically the first time I met Dr. Lesovoy, but it was a very, very powerful moment. And you can imagine what that was. I was thinking, you know, who let the janitor in, right? But here came this immense man with this enormous power. And, you know, you're thinking a doctor is going to have the white coat on and all that.
Yeah.
And he came in and changed my life forever. And it's really hard to describe this verbally, but emotionally, I always get choked up when I think about that pivotal moment in my life where I met Mal. And not only thankfully, and I'm blessed for it, that many years later we became incredible friends, but I had the opportunity to be under his care, and the way things turned out in a very positive manner. We did not know at that time, you know, what was going to happen with the legs. You know, was I ever going to be able to walk or run again? No, I can't run and all that, but I can walk. I'm still missing a third of the knee compartments, but I remember I had a cast on all the way from my hips down to my ankles, and Dr. Lesovoy ended up opening up the cast so he can observe and provide a diagnosis as to what my situation was. And I remember he said two things. First of all, don't look down, and I'm very bad at instructions. You know, I'm not very good at that. So there was my big takeaway was essentially is at that moment and point in time, I still have that smell in my nose of what that burned flesh smells like. Mm. I can smell it today. Mm. And then I knew at that time I was never under any circumstance going to be the same Cliff Meidel as I was before. Volleyball on the beach, running, being able to look normal in clothes and all of that. I was up against a new chapter in life where I was going to have to essentially reinvent myself and get through this difficult adversity. And then that's when I was placed into the care of Dr. Lessevoy.
Well, so Malcolm, let me ask you, so how did your decades-long friendship evolve? Because it did evolve, didn't it?
Yes, it did. So going back just a little bit, so we were able to bring him up to UCLA, and I did a number of procedures, operations with muscle flaps and blood vessels and skin grafts and stuff. And we were able to provide enough coverage and blood supply to the area that he did not have to have his legs amputated. However, that was just the very beginning. That was the easy part. The hard part was what Cliff had to do, because Cliff now had to be rehabilitated. You know, he was just in bed, wouldn't get out. He was, you know, 19-year-old snotty kid to a certain extent, you know, used to be an athlete and knew that he wasn't going to be an athlete anymore. And so I had to encourage him, basically kick his ass a couple times a week while he was in the hospital to get out of bed, to cooperate with the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, to really get moving. And basically, he had the gumption. He's truly the hero of this story because he did it. And after a couple of months in the hospital with rehabilitation and physical therapy and things of that sort, he would take one step forward, two steps backward, and then another two steps forward, and one step back, and so on and so forth, and really progressed. And then after this time period, I basically lost track of him. He was discharged, and we were just moving on in life and in my career and in his career. And then 10 years later, and this is where the story kind of becomes interesting, it was during the Atlanta Olympics. So it was 1996, Cliff?
96,
Yes.
Yeah, 96, where it was on a Sunday morning, and my phone starts ringing, and I answer the phone, and people kept calling me and said, you have to turn on CBS or NBC. I can't remember the station that the Olympics was on, the Atlanta Olympics. I said, there's this guy that's an Olympian, and he's being interviewed by these people, and they say that you're the guy that saved his life, that inspired him, and so on and so forth. And there it is. It's Cliff Meidel, who is an Olympian at the Atlanta Olympics.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. I'm getting goosebumps just telling you this story.
I'm getting goosebumps hearing you say how shocking that must have been for you to experience that. That must have been so incredibly emotional for you.
Yeah,
I can see. Yeah. Well, Cliff,
no,
I'm curious.
Go
ahead.
When you look back in that whole thing, you know, when you look back at, you know, when Dr. Lessevoy, when I first met him, but then as he said that, you know, he was very actively engaged in my rehabilitation because, as you know, when you go through extreme adversity, and many of our audience members probably understand this, as you go through these stages of grievance, you know, when you're angry, you're you know, ticked off, and there was always asking the question, you know, why did this happen to me? You go through a lot of this process, and ultimately you get to this point where there's a fork in the road where either you could throw the towel in or you can, you know, move forward and go under the direction of getting through this, you know, getting knocked on your butt and being able to brush yourself back off when you stand up and say, I'm going to do this. But the big question is, you know, a lot of times you're looking down a tunnel and you can't see the light at the end of it and you don't know how to do that. Well, that's what, you know, Dr. Lessevoy stepped in as I was going through the rehabilitation. He said, hey, Cliff, listen, I've done my 50%, or I've done the surgery, you're going to have to come up with the balance of the equation.
Wow.
Of course, me not being very good at math, I really didn't understand at a young age, what does that really mean?
Oh,
and
man.
What Dr. Lessevoy was alluding to was is that when you're going through adversity, whether it's setting goals in life or going through an extreme challenge, like I was trying to learn how to walk again, is that you're going to have to drive up that other percentage of the equation is driving up the willpower, first of all. Secondly, you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, so what do you have to do at that standpoint? You have to believe in yourself that you're going to be able to do that. And that's that acceptance phase during these stages of grievance. It's the belief process, and it's amazing how powerful, you know, creative visualization is. And Dr. Lessevoy lit that flame of hope again in my heart that I would get through this process. And like he said, he kicked me in the butt and really inspired me and said, listen, you got to get out of this hospital and get to a normal life. And, you know, when you're going through adversity like that, there's a lot of shame involved in all of this. And, you know, I wasn't happy of the way I looked or who I was and so on and so forth. And he really stepped in and kicked me into high gear to be able to not only get through this process where we talk about this Olympic thing, but also make me believe in who I am. And yes, I had the ability to do it, you know, and that's what the most important part of this entire relationship and how it fostered is that on many different fronts, you know, he had stepped in and provided, you know, what he needed to provide, whether it was in the role of a doctor or in the role of a second father, if that's proper to say that.
Right.
Mentor,
no, I get that.
You know, all of it
mentor.
Came together, you know, to be able to get me through this. Yeah.
I get it.
But to put this in perspective, Marcia,
that
was just at the very beginning. Then for 10 years, I never heard from this guy. I never saw him. I didn't. We totally lost contact with each other. And so, I mean, looking now 10 years later, when this person is an Olympian, because his brother said, listen, you know, you can't run anymore. You can definitely walk, but look at your upper body. You could use that. And that's when he kind of transformed his body, transformed himself, not because of me, because of suggestions from his brother and using his God-given talents, his God-given physical ability of his upper body for 10 years. Working out, learning, struggling, so on and so forth, and becomes an Olympic kayaker, and unbelievable. So it had nothing to do with me, except at the very, very, very beginning of this long journey that he did. But that's how we came in contact.
Right.
10 years later, which was unbelievable.
But I'm sure he would say, if it weren't for you, he wouldn't have had that Olympic experience.
But if
Cliff, just real briefly.
Yes.
Yeah, I just real briefly because I really want to talk about your Olympic experience. But could you go back into construction after you recovered, or did you leave that industry?
No, I was not able to do any type of manual labor. I was missing a third of my knee compartment in both legs. So I was, you know, I had knee immobilizers and crutches until ultimately I was able to wean myself off of that. You know, I still walked with knee braces. But my reintroduction into construction, now I'm a spokesperson for Georgia 811. But the whole part behind that started after I retired from the Olympics. I got back into construction as being a speaker and somebody that could go out and provide a testimony to those people that are boots on the ground that are working in the ditches and all that stuff and working on the construction sites. And so that was my contribution to be able to going back into the trade. But I can tell you now that, yeah, I really do miss not having that opportunity of being able to work into the trades and become a builder and all of that stuff. I think that, you know, if there is an emptiness in today's time, if I could unreel the tape, I would definitely want to go back and be able to have had that opportunity of being a tradesman, because I think it's an important part of us as human beings, you know, growing, whether we're men or women. I think it's an important part of the whole process is being able to do something that you're passionate about and something that you like to accomplish.
Well, let's talk about
this. Just a touch.
Sure. Go ahead.
I was just a little bit, and that is, after the Olympic games in Atlanta in 1996, 4 years later, Cliff, also still an Olympian, at the Sydney Olympics, and this is, I think, one of the highlights. And the highlight was such that, as we all remember, the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, which are coming up in Paris soon, the entire situation of Cliff and the U.S. Olympic team, 600 strong, the largest one, vote for one person to carry the flag at the opening ceremonies.
Yes.
And there you go. They voted for Cliff Meidel to carry that flag and walk on two legs around the entire stadium carrying that flag. I mean, I'm getting the chills just telling you this again, and we've talked about this I don't know how many innumerable times. But, I mean, what an unbelievable situation. What an unbelievable accomplishment of this man after such a tremendous adverse situation, traumatically, emotionally, physically, psychologically.
And he was young. He was young.
Exactly.
He was 19.
Exactly.
Gosh, his life was ahead of him. Well, let me interrupt you here, because what I'd like to find out from Cliff is how that all happened. How is it that you became an Olympic athlete in the 1996, the original, your first Olympics before the 2001 in Sydney? How did that come about?
Well, I needed a channel. I needed to get channel this energy, and as Mal had mentioned, that my brother was a very significant role in it, and he basically, it got me to believe in who I was and utilize the tools that God gave me, which was my upper body, because I ended up doing a lot of rehabilitation. You know, three times as much that was recommended, and I spent a lot of time in the weight room, and he introduced me into canoe paddling, which I got involved with, and after 10 years, you know, having mentors, becoming extremely physically fit, being able to, you know, travel the world and race canoes and kayaks and things like that, and, you know, I was ultimately able to accomplish my dream by going to the Olympic Games. And, you know, I've had, you know, besides Dr. Lesavoy, I also had mentors. There was a gentleman that I used to throw newspapers to in Manhattan Beach. His name is Tom Hintonhouse. And he was a local two-time Olympian as well. And he really inspired me to be able to go out there. And he planted that Olympic seed. And he was one of the first and most successful Calvin Klein male models ever. But he was a really instrumental part about that. And then also Greg Barton, you know, who is a two-time Olympic champion in sprint kayaking. And, you know, just seeing how he was, I really was a big dreamer as a young kid. I just dreamt, you know, that I wanted to be like this guy. In fact, I remember that when I was in seventh grade, I used to run down the ramp at PE. And I would get into this euphoric high running down the ramp, and I would be dreaming about competing in this large arena. But never, ever would I ever have thought that I would be able to accomplish anything like that. It was just a dream as a young kid. And then here I was walking into the opening ceremony in Atlanta. I was grabbing onto my coach's arm. He was helping me go down this ramp. And then all of a sudden, it felt like time had stopped. My blood was like oil. It was, you know, really thick. And all of a sudden, I realized, hey, wait a second. This is the dream that I had ever since I was a young little kid. And I think what the moral of the story is that, you know, some people will say, well, this gal is lucky because she accomplished that, or he's lucky because he did that. But I think that a good definition of being lucky is where persistence meets opportunity. It's all about the neck up. It's how bad we want to accomplish something, and we put our mind to it, and we put our human strengths, and we be the best person that we can be, and we go out there and try to accomplish that. And that's essentially how I got into the Olympics, you know, meeting tons of people at the canoe club and having positive, you know, response, having a belonging of something. And that kind of propelled that energy for me to want to go out there and be the best kayaker that Cliff Meidel could be.
I'm going to just quickly spell your names, because people that are listening may want to go visit your websites, although I will certainly include that in our follow-up blog. But Chris's Cliff's last name is spelled M-E-I-D-E-L.
Actually,
I'm sorry, I said that wrong. M-E-I-D-L. That's right. I said it incorrectly because I was looking at it wrong. And Dr. Lesavoy's, he also has a website, and you can find him. I'm going to spell Lesavoy for you, which is L-E-S-A-V-O-Y, lesavoyplasticsurgery.com, and you can find him too. And when you go to that website, you're going to go, oh, Dr. Phil, interesting. He was worked with Dr. Phil. But we aren't going to talk about Dr. Phil because this is about you guys. Back to the Olympics. So did you have to go, I mean, for people that have never been in the Olympics, did you have to go through this enormous tryout to be able to get selected to be on the team? I mean, how many people were on the team?
Well, we had, in 96, we had nine guys on the team, and then we had a team of gals as well. Excuse me. Then in Sydney, we had another six. So one of the things is when going to the Olympics, first of all, you got to get engaged in the sport, right? And then you've got to go through, you know, being able to train. And for me, you know, we always say accident Olympics, but, you know, there's 10 years of a lot of workload that goes into that process, you know. And so for me, I had to not only compete on a national level, but I had to go race internationally and things of that nature. And then, you know, ultimately the United States has its selection process. And so I had to go to the Olympic trials, and I did that, and I went to various different competitions across the country. And then, you know, ultimately I was able to make the Olympic team, you know, both times by doing that and qualifying boats in Europe at the World Championships and all that. But that's essentially how all that kind of comes together. It's a long process. There's a lot of setbacks. You know, we like Dr. Lesavoy said earlier, one step forward, two steps back, and that's the way life works, right? And nothing, you know, you could be one of the best paddlers on the Olympic team, and you may not make the team at trials because you may, have an issue, you know, or may not take that right stroke. Our sport is highly European dominated, and you could win by the thickness of a credit card over a 3-minute and 30-second race.
Wow.
Yeah, so
isn't
it's
that
a very intense process, and there's no guarantees with anything, yeah.
How is it you got selected to be the flag bearer? You said were there 600 people there, you said, at the Sydney Olympics?
Yeah, that's the size of the entire United States delegation, anywhere from 300 to 600, something of that nature. But so what happens is that each sport has a team captain, and Sydney, I believe it was 26 sports that we had. So your beach volleyball, your track and field, everybody has a team captain, and they send them to a very formal voting process where they all sit, and there's a presentation in terms of each team captain who they would like to elect as a flag bearer, and everybody comes up with these stories and all that, and the entire team captains vote on this whole process, and that's how it all goes through. Yeah, very formal. And I remember I was in Narrabeen, Australia, at a training camp for about a month before Sydney, and I had no idea really that this was going to happen because, you know, we had a lot of people on our team that are better deserving, you know, for these things. And then I remember I came back and my teammate Pete Newton said, dude, you're not going to believe this. And I go, what? He goes, you got elected as the flag bearer. And I thought, oh, come on, guys.
What?
This is just all nonsense because we all play jokes on each other all the time, right? Yeah, that's
sure.
The fun part of being on a team. And so then they said, no, you're the team, you're the flag bearer. And they all started punching me and all that stuff. But then, you know, all the formality happened where you do all your interviewing and then, you know, you're getting ready for that big night at the opening ceremony. And for me, it was really big because, A, I walk like Bambi, right? And I remember standing there with 2 billion viewers, I think it was, on TV. And holding the American flag. The pole is aluminum, drizzling out there, and it's conductive, right? Just kidding.
Uh-oh.
For our audience.
Uh-oh.
Just kidding. No, I was holding the American flag, and I was a couple of steps ahead of the entire delegation. I was so nervous. The only thing I could tell myself was, whatever you do, Cliff, don't trip. And I remember that this lady was screaming in my ear, okay, Cliff, get ready. Team USA, you're ready to go. And, you know, you could imagine a couple of 100,000 people in the audience. And there was the Bill Gates and all these people and all that. And I remember taking a deep breath, and my heart was coming out of my chest. And I remember looking over my shoulder, And the only thing that I could see was a sea of red, white, and blue behind me. It was the entire United States delegation following me in. And that was the most proud moment of my life. And, you know, I'm, you know, not only incredibly proud to be an American, but I'm so proud to be able to represent my country racing at two Olympic Games and all of that. It's an incredible experience.
I've heard this story innumerable times, and every single time I get the goosebumps. It's almost impossible to describe. Yeah, and not to, exactly.
But you know, Malcolm, here's the thing, and you are a very humble man, and I'm sure that Cliff would agree with that, and that is had. And let's not forget about your mom here, because she played a huge role in this.
Yeah.
Had your mom not gotten in touch with Dr. Lacevoy, this would never have happened. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now. And that's what I find just so, so remarkable. And it's just phenomenal. And so let me ask you this, Doc. Have you performed similar surgeries since that one that saved Cliff's legs?
Yes, yes, it's not that I invented that particular procedure, but it was in plastic and reconstructive surgery. It's not just the cutting and sewing; it's the thought process of how can we fix this particular hole, or how can we reconstruct this breast after cancer, or how can we fix this hand, or how can we take this 3-month-old baby and make them look normal instead of being born
with a cleft palate,
with the appearance of a monster or something of that sort. And so it's a thought process. I mean, anybody can cut and sew, but moving tissues from one place to the other. So I was very fortunate just to, I guess, the perseverance of Cliff's mom and kind of arguing with the doctors that didn't want to release him at the time. But that's the smallest part of this whole story. The larger part is the stick-to-itiveness, is the inspiration. And Cliff and I talk to groups a lot about this. I'm inspired every time, every single time I listen to Cliff. And listen to his commitment and to his inspiring speeches. And we give these talks frequently to medical groups or to Rotary clubs and things of that sort.
Yes.
But it's inspiration that Cliff gives forward and projects. To an audience, which is just fantastic. I'm inspired every single time I listen to him, and listening to him deep down is the important part, really, in my opinion.
He said something that I wrote down because I thought it was so significant when he said persistence meets opportunity.
For sure.
And I think that is that's a real good summing up of how this happened. And I would imagine you've had other stories that are like this. Do you have another story you'd like to share about maybe another remarkable surgery you've performed?
There are. I've been around quite a while.
You've been doing this a while.
I've had the opportunity of doing new things, using my mind and technical skills to invent new procedures and things of that sort, rather than, in plastic surgery, we do all kinds of things aside from aesthetic surgery. But I was in a particular situation where a young man was on a motorcycle and was in an accident, and his leg was actually amputated, and when I was brought to UCLA to do microsurgery and all kinds of reconstruction, I happened to be there at the time when he was brought in by the ambulance, with his leg cut off, and his leg actually came in a second ambulance. It wasn't even in the same car. So I figured, unbeknownst to the history of this type of situation, I said, well, geez, I mean, I could fix this leg. I mean, I could put plates and screws on. I can fix the arteries and the veins and the nerves and the tendons and stuff. And so I just went forward. I mean, sometimes when you don't know that you can't do something, you go ahead and do it. It happened. So it was successful. And he was 17 at the time. This now is considered the first leg replantation in the world. And I actually published it.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I published it in 1979. It was pretty rare because, you know, you see Olympians actually running on prostheses.
Absolutely.
On these fantastic prosthetics. And the problem is that a prosthetic can never give you sensation or sensibility to the bottom part of your foot. You can't feel it from a piece of metal or a fake leg. And so just thinking that I could hook those nerves up serendipitously so that he could feel the bottom of his foot. And he actually walked down at graduation in high school, walked on two legs, going down.
Wow.
And I didn't know it at the time that it was the first time that a leg was replanted. The Chinese had, very interestingly, who are the real pioneers in microsurgery and replantation, but they actually did transfer a leg, but that was 3 or 4 days afterwards where they took a right leg and put it on the left upper leg and put a prosthesis on the other side. And it really wasn't a replantation. It was a transfer. So this particular one, anyhow, I just happened to be lucky and not smart enough to know that it couldn't be done. So it's very rarely done.
You have a never give up attitude, my friend. That's why there's nothing that you wouldn't tackle. So that does. I actually had a guest on my show a couple of years ago that competed in the Paralympics, playing hockey, sitting in a chair, because she had lost both of her legs. Yes. So Cliff, I want to ask you something, Cliff. So you obviously you're not in the Olympics any longer, but what are you doing currently? You had mentioned it sounds like you do some motivational speaking. Is that right?
Yes, I do. I do a lot of motivational speaking, and I also do a lot of speaking in the safety industry as well. So that's kind of what I do. And I sit on a couple of boards for local Southern California Olympians and Paralympians organization. I work a lot with different foundations. I do an annual kayak day down at the Newport Aquatic Center in Newport Beach. So I've been involved in that for many years. And, you know, I try to stay active. You got to stay busy and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's important in life. And I also, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a vice president for a development company. So that's my 9-to-5.
Sure.
It sounds like he's selling himself short. He's extremely bright, a bright gentleman, and people have a lot of trust in his ideas and his finances and so on and so forth. So he's one in a million.
Something. How is it that Malcolm is just so willing to push the spotlight off of himself? Is that typical for him?
It is. And I was going to comment on that. When, I have to go ahead and do a plug for Dr. Lessenway, because he's got to be one of the most humble people in the world. And his personality, as you know, just speaking with him is infectious. You know, he's always puts a smile on everybody's face, and he'll take a difficult situation and make it easy for you to understand, and he'll make it easy for you to get through it. He is a pioneer in his industry. Everybody knows Dr. Malcolm Lessenway, and I mean, I can tell you story after story after story on how all this works. In fact, I'll tell you a real quick one here is I was,
sure.
you know, at my older age, I'm lifting weights in the gym. There's this one local kid, a friend of mine that is getting into kayaking and he's doing all this stuff. So we go to the gym and lift. And one of his friends was lifting with us for a while and he goes, what happened to you? You know, they always have that strange look, you know, you look kind of messed
yeah.
up. What happened to you? So obviously you got to get into the story and all that kind of stuff. Here we go again, you know, take 100,000 times. But anyway, so he goes, oh yeah, my parents are doctors. And I said, oh really? And I said, have you ever heard of Dr. Malcolm Lesovoy? And he goes, well, I haven't, but let me ask my dad. So 2 weeks later, he comes back. And he goes, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what? He said that my father was mentored by Dr. Lesovoy. So he was one of thousands that have come from all around the world to be able to learn from Dr. Lesovoy. And he is not only a pioneer, but he's a mentor in the industry. He teaches a lot of people the practice of medicine and how to be the best reconstructive surgeon that you can be. And he provides one of the most important parts is he inspires them to be the best that they can be, and that's critical. Well, what ended up happening is we ended up getting invited by him. His name is Dr. Chris DiVirgilio, and he's not only a friend of Dr. Lesovoy's, but also, as I mentioned, a mentor. And we did one speech right now that was Grand Rounds at Harbor UCLA in Carson, mm-hmm. and we're able to do a speech there. But it's amazing. I mean, Dr. Lesovoy has tons of stories as well about how all this, you know, circle of life comes around. My wife was walking our golden retriever many years ago during the 2012 Olympics, and here's this guy, a neighbor of ours that looks like he's out his ZZ Top. Well, they were talking about the Olympics, and he goes, I know this Olympian, and my wife goes, who's that? And he says, his name is Cliff Meidel. And my wife goes, oh, boy, I'm married to that guy, right? Hopefully she had a better answer than that. But anyway, it turns out that you know what his role in this whole story was? He was the first person on scene that revived me when I was in my accident. So
you're
like the
kidding.
Circle of life. And he's a neighbor of mine. So it's amazing how the world is like Olympic rings. It's all these circles and everybody's coming together. It's that 6 degrees of separation. But Dr. Lesovoy is the hero, and he's inspired thousands of people in his industry and in life. And I'm very proud to be a part of his process, and I'm honored.
I see a TED Talk here. I don't know if you guys have ever done that or not, but I can just see you being on stages where, I mean, what industry wouldn't want you speaking? I mean, it's such an encouraging relationship, because each of you are passing it off to the other, which I find really, really cool. And so Cliff, let me ask you, because I know we don't have a lot of time left. You mentioned that you're speaking professionally. So do you speak to just construction people, or do you speak to all types of people?
Oh, all types of people. Anybody that wants to hire me, whether you're Fortune 500 or your construction company,
okay.
Fortune 500, it really doesn't matter. My story shares a lot of different facets that come together. I speak a lot on overcoming adversity, as you've
mm-hmm.
heard in a lot of what we had discussed today. And I also
mm-hmm.
talk a lot about how that applies into working safe on the work site. So I always like to inject the human behavioral side of things and how we can make choices to be able to be going out there and working safe 24/7. So my story bodes in many different areas. And for Dr. Lesovoy and I, if anybody out there in our audience has an opportunity for us, we'll take it. We love speaking together. It allows us to spend time together.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to inspire other people to be the best that they can be. And whether it's technical, as Dr. Lesovoy said earlier, whether we can speak or have the opportunity to speak to the medical industry or any industry, we'd love to do it. And if you can have us come out and speak, we'll be there, ready to go.
I think that's just fabulous. I'm certainly going to mention this to my daughter. In these last few moments, Malcolm, what's up next for you? Is there something that you're looking to do in the near future that's on your agenda?
Well, the future is always, always bright. And I do now aesthetic surgery, facelifts, breasts, tummy tucks, all this kind of stuff now to continue to make a living. And I used to, either before Zoom, actually, I was visiting professor at a lot of different places around the world and doing surgery, demonstration and lecturing and so on and so forth. But, you know, Zoom really cut down, not Zoom, but you know, COVID cut down all of this,
the pandemic,
this travel stuff. Exactly.
Right.
But Cliff and I, we really enjoy each other's company, as hopefully you can tell. And
yes.
I learn so much from him every time we talk. And our our talks are always different. And it's interesting. We have a whole really great slide presentation, PowerPoint situation for people. And we can give as short as 15, 20-minute talks or 2 or 3 hour talks and seminars and things of that sort. And we really enjoy it. And I learn so much each time we do this, and from Cliff, and it's really it's been a life-changing situation for me. And I mean, I have many, many patients, you know, I mean, thousands. I've been, been doing this for a long time, over 40 years. And, but I learn from every single patient, but this guy is, I mean, he's, you know, he's unbelievable, truly unbelievable in so many different ways. But the inspiration and the persistence, mostly inspiration, that we all gain from listening to him and listening to his story and listening to the adversity that he went through as a kid, essentially 19
right.
years old. I mean, who does something like that?
Right.
We know many people that do it, but not to that same level and not to the same, to the goal that he achieved, which is unbelievable.
Well, and you know, Cliff, let me just say this. I'm a parent as well. I'm sure that you have an enormous respect for your parents and how they stood by you as you went through all of this. And your brother, you mentioned you had a brother. It's pretty remarkable what you've been able to accomplish. And do you have some... something that's just up next for you that you're just like, you know, this is, I really want to be able to do this. Do you have it on your go-to list?
Yeah, I have something that I have shelved for many years. I was doing a literary project with a gentleman by the name of Ron Rappaport out of the Chicago Sun-Times many years ago, and we created together a manuscript in order to kind of use that as a vehicle to potentially publish a book one day. And so we basically put it on the shelf because I was still in the process of developing life experiences and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of my days, my dream would be to be able to write a book. I'd love to do something like that, and that would lead into doing a speaking campaign that would be around that. Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to stick my hand up in the air because I know people in the film industry. This is a movie, dude. You can write the book. I think the book would be great, but I can't be the first person that has said, man, this is a movie. This is a documentary. I'm certain that I cannot be the first person that has said that to you, right?
Yeah, I think that the great part about it is that the way the story weaves with Dr. Lesboy and I and the friendship that goes behind it and, you know, how all of this came about. You know, I mean, we could, as Dr. Lesboy said, you know, we could do a 2 or 3 hour speech very easily on all of our stories that we have in our back pocket, you know, and how all of this works. I mean, there's so much of this that is part of human development and human life. I mean, everybody can benefit from this and listening to these stories, because what it does is it allows you an opportunity to sit back and reflect and say, hey, man, I went through something like this in life, or, you know, here's you know, what I did and all that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, when we listen to things, I think the important part of storytelling and story sharing is be able to provide us, as Dr. Lesboy said, it's a vehicle for us to become inspired. It's a vehicle for us, if we're going through hardship, to be able to develop that initial spark to be able to stand up and believe in yourself and look in the mirror and say, I'm going to be able to accomplish this. You know, do we have a blueprint on how we're going to get through it? That's not important at all whatsoever. It's just about believing
right.
ourselves initially. And as Dr. Lesovoy said, you know, in his trade that he is in, it's all about being able to use the mind. He had said anybody can cut and sew, but it's being able to take that creativity and apply it into the current situation. I think that for all of our audiences, Dr. Lesovoy and I have something for them. You know, we have something for you out there if you would like to listen to us and all that. So we want to inspire you to do the best that you can do.
Well, and, you know, that is inspiring. And you know, we never know when we share these stories. I know, you know, next week I'll have different guests. We never know by sharing a story how someone that's listening may be affected. Look, I mean,
exactly.
Look at your mom. You know, if you live in a box with your hands preventing you from seeing on either side, and you're just closing in, you're missing out on an opportunity. And we don't know where these opportunities come from, but if you're able to share them and provide that kind of inspiration, as you mentioned, then it's the gift that keeps on giving. I guess that's how I would say that. And I feel that way when I have such remarkable guests as both of you gentlemen today. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with me. I know we did a lot of prep work ahead of time, which was hilarious, I might add, and that this has just been a very inspiring story, and I just want to thank you both so much for sharing your part in that. It's been fabulous.
It was our honor to participate, and we really thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, this was awesome.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I look forward to following along, and I can't wait to read the book and see the documentary. So we'll have to see what we can do about that, all right? But for now, we're going to just – yeah, there you go. Well, for those of us that are in the Los Angeles area having more rain than we ever wish we could ever have, you know, just be safe out there, everyone. I know that there's crazy weather everywhere, but – we've had certainly our share of rain lately, so but let's not let it damper what a fabulous opportunity this was to get to know each other. And once again, just thank you so very much for spending this afternoon with me. It's been fabulous. Thank you. Okay, everybody, there you have it. So actually, I have a nurse next week. Well, you just never know who's going to be joining me, right? So thank you so much, everyone. Be safe, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.